This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we learn about a very special dress on display in Rugby, North Dakota. But we are going to start in Jamestown because the Arts Center Downtown Arts Market is returning. Lovely to see events coming back across the state. And there's also going to be a Chalk Fest in Jamestown coming up later this summer. Joining me now is Mindy Schmitz. She is the executive director of the Jamestown Arts Center. Mindy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Ashley. Appreciate it.
And we also have Sean McCann. He is a chalk artist. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Wonderful to be here.
Mindy, let's just start with, what was the 2020 season like for you?
Well, we actually did have a COVID-19 awareness season last year of the Downtown Arts Market. We were encouraging mask wearing and social distancing. And so we did have a version of the Downtown Arts Market, and the people of Jamestown and the surrounding area really appreciated it. And so we were able to bring live performances and some activities downtown here.
Did it seem like it impacted attendance compared with years past?
Yeah, it was a lot lighter attendance, but you know, the people that were there were very appreciative, and you know, we were really glad to do it.
Yeah. So did that make planning the 2021 season just kind of easy?
Yeah, it did make it easy. We had a lot of performers that contacted us and said that they want to come, and when can they come? And we didn't have any kind of vendors or market last year, and so the vendors are really and ready to come back too, and so we're really looking forward to it this summer.
All right. Well, and those downtown arts markets are Thursdays in the summer months starting June 24th, and also this year, June 24th through 26th, is the inaugural Chalk Festival. Sean, that's where you come in here. How did you get started specifically in chalk art? Because you have done a lot of different kinds of art.
Yeah, chalk art is something that I kind of came about accidentally years ago, back in, like, I think it was 2005. And somebody had seen a painting of mine and asked if I could recreate it on the sidewalk. And I did it, and I absolutely loved the process of creating art out in the public setting, and that just kind of took off from there, and now it's my full-time career. I travel all over the world creating street art pieces for festivals and events and all sorts of fun things.
Well, and I have come across some unexpected sidewalk art before and had that absolutely kind of trippy experience because it's very much oftentimes these optical illusions where you are creating depth and, you know, three dimensions. And I thought I was about to fall into a puddle at one point. Do you ever get to just sit back and watch people interact with the art like that?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And even some of the permanent murals I've done, I've added some element of that anamorphic art, and watching people kind of try and figure it out, seeing what it looks like, and then, you know, interacting with it is so much fun.
Yeah. I don't have any understanding of where to begin, how to create an optical illusion. Are you starting with a mathematical formula? I honestly, I have no idea where to start.
Yeah, it is a lot of math, and there is one specific vantage point that we always start with, and that's why with the 3D street art, it looks so strange from all the way around the piece until you get to that magic wow moment. And when you find that one spot, which is usually, we'll usually paint like a set of feet on the ground just so you know where to stand and take that photo.
Oh, sure.
But it's really stretched out. It's distorted, you know, from every other angle. It really looks kind of strange, but it's fun when you do find that exact spot and you see that magic happen.
So do you have to kind of plot that out on paper or what first?
Yeah, the 3D artists, we have to, you know, definitely come up with the concept ahead of time. We have to work out the details of, you know, where it's going to be, because you have to take into the account the curve of the street, because there is always kind of a hump in the middle. So you have to sometimes flare the sides up a little bit just so you flatten out that image and make it look right. And so there's a lot of pre-prep that goes into it. And then, you know, the day of the event and the weekend of the event, it's just a matter of, you know, being on site and making any, you know, additional adjustments that need to be made for the 3D ones.
Yeah, even just painting a wall at home, just a normal, I'm changing my walls from gray to sage green. I'm like, man, this is so much prep work. Mindy, when did you first become aware of Sean's art?
Well, Sean and I hail from the same hometown, which is Wahpeton, North Dakota. And we work closely here at the Art Center with art centers across the state. And Wayne Byers is a good friend of ours. And Wayne had mentioned that they had had Sean and a couple other folks, I think, Sean, at a similar sort of festival in Wahpeton last year. And I thought, man, we need to do something like that here. And so I reached out to Wayne first, and Wayne got me connected with Sean, and here we are.
Yeah, man, we got to get something like that here. Why chalk?
I'm part of the Jamestown Downtown Association, and a couple of those folks were talking about chalk art at a meeting. Hmm. And then this came up with Wayne, and we thought, all right, well, let's make the connection and let's see if we can pull it off.
What do you need to pull it off?
Well, we need financial backing, of which we're getting quite a few sponsors, namely the Jamestown Tourism is a big financial sponsor. And then we needed cooperation with, you know, Jamestown City. Do we have to close off the street? And, you know, and we're working with the local downtown vendors here to do coupons for food and get people excited to be downtown and spend their money here locally. So,
and how do you get Mother Nature involved?
Well, we're going to do a lot of talking to Mother Nature the week before.
Excellent.
And prepping her that we really need this to happen. And so hopefully she will shine upon us, literally.
Sean, how does the weather impact specifically chalk art?
Chalk art is one of those magic things to where Mother Nature is always trying to lend her hand at and messing it up, whether it's the wind blowing the chalk away or the rain trying to wash it away. It's just something that we always have to deal with. And, you know, we have tarps to cover it if there's a little rain shower or something like that. And, but the great thing about all of the chalk artists that, that do this is they're accustomed to that and they're used to working with Mother Nature. And, you know, we just work through it. And if we have to take a little rain break, we do and continue it. But we definitely look forward to beautiful sunny skies and you know, calm winds and huge crowds. So
under perfect conditions, which is always the case in North Dakota weather, how long would a finished piece of chalk art last?
Well, if you don't have a lot of rain, some of the chalk art pieces can last for, you know, a few weeks to a couple of months.
Okay.
The 3D pieces are done with a liquid chalk called tempera because a lot of those people will end up posing with. And so you have people standing on it and interacting with it, if you use the regular chalk pastel, it would smear the first time somebody got on it. But the liquid version of that allows you to interact. And so those last a little bit longer. But since it will be opened back up to a street, probably that, you know, Saturday night, Sunday, it'll last as long as the traffic will allow. So it is just a magic. You get to kind of see it being taken back by nature. And it's more about the art of creation and watching artists come together that really makes them special.
Yeah, I want to talk about that mindset of creating something that you just 100% know is not going to last. This won't end up in special bulletproof glass in a museum with all sorts of fancy lighting and security guards. Some of the art that you do, for example, you also illustrate books, that's going to last. But this mindset of creating for creation's sake, is the mindset different?
I don't think so. I think if you think of it as like a musician having a concert, you listen to it and you remember it forever. It's something that lasts for, you know, a certain amount of time and then it's over. And with the creation of the chalk art, I think people actually take it in more knowing that it's going to be gone because they want that experience. They want to really dig into this ephemeral art form. And, you know, if it's something that you put up, you know, on a wall or something, sometimes people will see it every day and forget about it. And it just becomes part of your daily life. With the chalk art festivals, it's something that people just really love to take in and see how it's created, see the process, come back, see how they're coming together. And we found throughout the country and even around the world, the festivals I've gone to, people will just gravitate towards these festivals and come back year after year because they get to see some of the same artists sometimes. They get to know people. They get to just see these magical creations come together.
Do you ever have to see some people who, like you said, the non-liquid chalk can wear out really quickly? Do people ever come up and just immediately smear everything you just put into that?
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully it's something that people will stand back and not try and destroy. It is something that, you know, after the street is opened up, you know, there are people who will sometimes wish that cars weren't driving over it. But it's something we get plenty of photographs. We really document the process well. And that's where they live on. And that's where people can, you know, find more about all of these artists and the work that they've done over the years. And but we do not encourage people to freely come up and, you know, try and mess with them while we're working on them and before they're done. So
that is artist Sean McCann. He will be one of the featured artists at Chalk Fest, which is coming up in Jamestown, June 24th through 26th. We're also visiting today with Mindy Schmitz, the executive director of the Jamestown Arts Center. Mindy, in addition to Chalk Fest, Thursdays throughout the summer, you will be having the Downtown Arts Market. We mentioned a little bit of this. There will be some outdoor live music, some vendors, some different kind of hands-on activities for people. So give us a preview of what you are most looking forward to, I guess, outside of Chalk Fest.
Well, sure. Like you said, every Thursday night we bring in a performer, and then we also have local vendors that will be selling their wares and those kinds of things. But some of the performers that I'm most looking forward to is we have North Dakota's favorite daughter, Jessie Veter, is kicking it off with Chalk Fest on June 24th. And then we have Fargo's own Deb Jenkins Band is
also
coming.
Amazing.
July 15th. Yep. And then for those who like polka, we got Matt Hoduk and the Dakota Dutchman are coming. That's very popular. And then we have the Kix Dixieland Band is coming. And in between there, we have quite a few other local bands. And we also have a very popular open mic night, which is happening once a month, too. So we have a full slate from June 24th through August 26th on Thursday nights.
And you can find out more about each of those events at jamestownarts.com. Mindy, that open mic night, is this comedy? Is this singing? Is it slam poetry? Sure.
It's a little bit of everything. It's a little bit of everything. I tell people, even if you think you've got talent, come on down, because people are doing a little bit of everything here, I tell you.
What would you do on open mic night?
Stay away from the mic.
Oh, come on. You have to do what you're asking other people to do.
I can recognize that I don't have much talent.
Oh, I don't believe that at all, especially the talent of organizing. But yes, I get that that's a hard one to do on an open mic night.
I'll stay behind the scenes.
We need those people too. Sean, I'm wondering about coming back to your home state. I know you're not from Jamestown, but you are from Wahpeton, but you have done installations at Disney. You are one of the very few American artists chosen to participate in Dubai Canvas. You have been featured twice at the LA Times Festival of Books as the featured illustrator. Let's do a little compare and contrast of the local small town art appreciation versus this big world stage. So let's go to the Dubai Canvas first. What is this experience like?
Well, it's everything you imagine it could be, going to a place that has no limits when it comes to kind of overabundance and just everything's bigger there. It's the world's largest skyscraper is there.
Yeah.
And it's just everything is done to the, you know, 10th degree. So it was such an honor to be there with 20 of the other world's top street artists and to kind of celebrate street art as an art form, and to be able to create for people that come from all over the world, because every other person you meet there is from a different country. And the worldwide experience is something that you can never forget. It's just, to see the world is just, it's inspiring, and you get to meet so many wonderful people. But there's something special about coming home to where you grew up and bringing those experiences and bringing the amazing artists that get to come with you to your home state and really celebrate that art form as well. And, you know, we're so fortunate to be able to have, you know, a number of different events and opportunities throughout the state, and they're multiplying. And I really love that North Dakota is celebrating the arts in so many wonderful ways, whether it's music or street art or the arts markets and things like that. And so it means a lot to be able to come back and share those experiences and create for everyone who kind of helped, you know, encourage what I do when I was younger.
You said getting people to recognize street art as an art form. Is that still a tough sell, even in 2021?
I think in communities that haven't experienced it, it sometimes can be, because to be able to get communities to even like allow for murals to happen and things like that, there's sometimes a lot of pushback because they think it's going to be graffiti or it's going to be something that doesn't look very good. And so there's always, whenever something new comes about that hasn't, you know, been a part of the community before, there's always a little bit. But it's been so much in the social media and other areas that it is something that it's a lot easier now, because people have had that opportunity to see it being done elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And they're really excited that it's, you know, finally coming to areas that typically wouldn't have had it before. And so that's what's really fun about, you know, starting new festivals and new opportunities in areas like in Jamestown.
I was up on your website, and it's seanmccann.com, and it's a very user-friendly website. Lots of great pictures, as you would want from an artist's website. And I'm always curious about people and their approach to branding themselves, and especially because it becomes sort of this classic left brain, right brain thing. Are you creative or analytical or one of the unicorns who's both? So the process of, what's your approach to the business of being an artist?
Well, the business is something that, you know, some artists tend to shy away from, and that can make it a little bit difficult, because you really need to know all the different aspects of your art and the business side of what you do, because if you're not able to take on those roles, then it's harder for others to sell what you do, because you have to like have them speak for you. And as an artist, as a street arts organizer, and you know, putting together all the different contracts and marketing and making sure all those things, I think it gives you a little bit more control and a little bit more you know, kind of step in the fact that you can, you know, kind of control where you go with your career. And it's something that, you know, it isn't something that just magically happens overnight. There's a lot of work. I've been doing this for, you know, 15, 16 years. And it's always a constant struggle to keep that momentum going, because it's such a physical activity, creating art on the street or on the wall or, you know, out in Mother Nature. But it's such a rewarding one. And the people I've been able to meet over the years and interact with have just been so inspiring to keep doing this as long as I can. And that's kind of where the organizing of the different chalk festivals in areas in the Midwest and stuff has really come into play, because that allows for a lot of what I do to be able to bring some of those artists I meet along the way into, you know, our home area and celebrate that. So it's really fascinating.
Sean McCann is an artist, and he will be doing his chalk art at the inaugural Chalk Fest coming up this June 24th through 26th in Jamestown. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And also coming up in Jamestown throughout the summers, check out Thursday evenings starting June 24th for the Downtown Arts Market. Mindy Schmitz is the executive director of the Jamestown Arts Center. Mindy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, Natural, North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, Know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Some are dipping their toes.
I'm sure we will all still be taking proper precautions.
While others are ready to roll.
Thankfully, the pandemic seems like it's almost run its course.
And there are people who might still be home for a while.
Plants don't have eyes, so it's hard for me to trust them.
Whether the events you want to attend are virtual or in person, it's nice to have a central place where you can learn about them. Just go to prairiepublic.org, click on community, and find our events calendar.
I like it a lot.
And hey, if you want to let our audience know about an event you're planning, you can submit one. Let your fun time start with Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Are you one of those people that sometimes looks at deer or turkeys or squirrels and thinks, why do I have a Netflix subscription? Well, I think biologist Chuck Lura would agree. Here is a Natural North Dakota essay on chipmunks.
We have some chipmunks around our yard that are providing us with some great entertainment. They've been busy scurrying around, often cleaning up spilled sunflower seeds from our bird feeders. And, of course, they occasionally crawl up on a platform feeder to gather sunflower seeds until their cheek pouches look like they're going to burst before heading out to stash them for later use. Chipmunks generally construct burrows underground, perhaps by a rock, log, among some roots and the like. It looks like one family has found a spot under our deck to their liking. They'll likely cache the sunflower seeds there. I've read that a cache may consist of up to a bushel of seeds and nuts. Two species of chipmunks are native to North Dakota. The eastern chipmunk can be found in Turtle Mountain, Pembina Hills, and the Red River Valley, while the least chipmunk can be found largely southwest of the Missouri River, along with the Turtle Mountains and Pembina Hills. They're rather easy to differentiate. The eastern chipmunk is about 10 inches long, including about 4 inches of tail. As the name implies, the least chipmunk is a little smaller. It's a couple inches shorter and weighs about half that of the eastern chipmunk. An easier way to differentiate the two species, particularly when their ranges overlap, such as Turtle Mountain and Pembina Hills, is by how they hold their tail when they run. Eastern chipmunks typically run with their tails held straight back. But if you see one running with its tail straight up, that's a least chipmunk. What we've been watching mostly is least chipmunks. The chipmunks should start having their young soon. That'll take their entertainment value to a new level. Speaking of chipmunks and entertainment, no doubt some of you have watched Chippendale cartoons over the years. And in the 1960s, Alvin and the Chipmunks, Alvin, Simon, and Theodore, were all over the TV and radio waves with their hits The Witch Doctor and the Chipmunk song Christmas Don't Be Late. Alvin and the Chipmunks are still on television. And somewhere in our house, tucked away with my other LPs, is the Chipmunk Sing the Beatles Hits. A Christmas gift for my childhood. Such were the 1960s. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, we learn about an expanded food security program for kids and about a very special black dress on display in Rugby. But now, it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Leaders with the North Dakota AFL-CIO say a law passed by the legislature this session will make it virtually impossible for anyone impacted with asbestos-related illness to claim damages from makers of those products. House Bill 1207 will take effect August 1st. Landis Larson is president of North Dakota AFL-CIO. He says asbestos has been used in workplaces from the 1940s all the way through the 1990s, such as power plants, oil refineries, sugar beet plants, office buildings, and even courthouses, private homes, and auto repair businesses. He says even U.S. Navy ships contain structural materials with asbestos. Larson says the new law creates barriers to patients entitled to damages for sickness due to exposure.
I Googled it on my phone. The average life expectancy for someone with mesothelioma is 18 months. I don't believe that's even close to enough time to get it through the court system at all. So anybody that's really damaged by asbestos will never see any relief in their lifetime.
Larson says AFL-CIO is urging any worker who may have been exposed to asbestos to visit their doctor for a four-view chest x-ray to look for asbestos-related damage and to send that x-ray to an attorney that specializes in asbestos litigation in North Dakota by July 15th. Minnesota investigators are looking into chronic wasting disease in Beltrami County. It had been found in deer on a farm, and it has now spread to five additional farms. That herd was quarantined last fall, and the animals were killed. A total of 13 deer tested positive for CWD. State Board of Animal Health senior veterinarian Courtney Wheeler says investigators found a number of connections to other farms in several Minnesota counties. Wheeler says the geographic range of the spread is worrying.
We're trying to make sure that we haven't spread, you know, CWD throughout the state, and then obviously that we're not going to spread CWD to any wild animals as well.
Minnesota's Department of Natural Resources says this incident changes the risk assessment and concern about chronic wasting disease in Minnesota. And parts of north central and northeastern North Dakota could see frost tonight. Bill Barrett is with the National Weather Service in Grand Forks.
The cold front actually came through yesterday, as everyone was probably well aware of, with the high winds. And so we're going to be running several degrees, maybe 10 degrees or even 15 below average the next couple of days. And when you get that, you start getting us well down into the 30s overnight. And that offers the possibility for some scattered frost.
Barrett says overnight the frost will be in the northern tier of counties, but by Friday,
we may get some frost penetration a little bit farther south. So maybe down to as far south as Highway 200 or, well, Highway 2 or perhaps even Highway 200, if you want to make a dividing line there, because we'll be in the low to mid-30s throughout that region.
But Barrett says as the Memorial Day weekend rolls on, the temperatures will rise. He says by Monday, highs will be in the 70s. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Many women have a black dress in their wardrobe, but trust me, you don't have one like the one on display at the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby. I recently stopped by that museum to visit about this special dress with Executive Director Jennifer Willis.
We're standing in front of a dress that belonged to Queen Victoria of England. She reigned from 1837 to 1901.
Yeah, the queen.
Yes.
And what is her dress doing in Rugby, North Dakota?
Well, her dress kind of had a long history. You know, after her husband Albert died, she went into mourning and remained that way until she died herself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the dress itself is black to signify that. Mm-hmm. And one of her servants, Marie Downing, had worked for her for 8 years, I believe. When she told the queen that she wanted to move to the Dakotas to get married, the queen let her go, and she gave her a pension of about $60 every 2 weeks, which, you know, for that time was pretty good. And the lady, Marie, when she came over, she only had one trunk of clothing. And she gets here and realizes or finds out that the queen had actually sent several more trunks of gifts, including this dress. It ended up being donated to the Rolla Library in 1977, where it was displayed during that time. And then in 2017, we donated the dress.
Do you have a sense of how much this garment is worth?
I think it's priceless.
Did you have to take special precautions?
We did have the case specially made for the dress, and we keep it in a room that is temperature, it stays pretty stable, and the lighting, of course, is LED to protect the fabrics from deteriorating.
Yeah, what would a fabric be prone to?
Just the fading and general deterioration due to the lighting and changes in temperatures otherwise.
Since this is radio, could you paint a mental picture? What does this dress look like?
Queen Victoria was rather short, and so the dress itself, I think, would be about 5 foot from the shoulder to the floor. It has a train. It's black with white trim around the bodice, embroidery, and it buttons on the top. And then there's a lot of more embroidery around the skirt. And the sleeves themselves have tassels hanging from them. I would say they're probably about at elbow length. Mm-hmm. with a lot of white underneath to fluff them up.
How do we know it was really Queen Victoria's?
We've done a lot of research, and we do have images of Queen Victoria in the dress and the history that came along with Marie Downing at the time.
What else do we know about Marie Downing? What made her want to go from England to the Dakotas? Working for the Queen, I'm sure, was hard, but probably a pretty good job at the time.
Well, from what I understand, she was one of the Queen's favorite servants. And every time she would try to leave, the Queen would call her back saying that her replacement wasn't good enough or something to that extent. But then she finally told the Queen that she had fallen in love and wanted to move here to get married.
What do we know about Mr.?
Well, he was Henry Williams. He was initially a footman and then a butler. And he left the service of his employer in 1882. And he and Marie did not see each other for 5 years while he was on his way to America. And he ended up actually in Canada before coming to North Dakota. He came here to Homestead near Rolla.
Is it true that for decades, not only was this dress just on display at the library, but that people could put it on and wear it?
I'm not certain about that, but I know it was not in any sort of protective case for the majority of that time.
How does that feel as the executive director of a museum to hear something like that? Like, no, let's, please.
It makes you cringe a little, but at the same time, you kind of think, well, that would have been kind of neat to try on too,
yeah.
You know, but yeah. Now I would be scared to touch it.
Has the current royal family ever reached out and said, we want this dress back?
Not back permanently. They had asked to borrow it for one of their celebrations a few years ago, but for some whatever reason, it actually didn't ever make it out of our possession.
Or somebody here just said no to the royal family, you can't borrow this?
Well, I'm not sure. It may have just been the loan, what was in the loan, whether or not, you know, who was responsible for its upkeep and safety.
Right. Do you have any idea, a sense of what it would be like? How do you ship this back to England? How do you, I mean, all those things.
It would take a lot of studying, you know, research to make sure we did it properly. Of course, you'd use archival tissue paper and boxes of that nature. And then, of course, you'd want to insure it. And finding out its value would really be the main goal of the whole thing.
What happened to your insurance bill after you added this dress to your collection?
Well, our insurance bill isn't too bad. It's bearable.
Do we know about this dress specifically? They went to so many things as royals.
Right. This one was worn during the 1870 Knight of the Garter ceremony. There were no photographs of the ceremony itself. It's still the style frequently worn by her.
Well, and it seems funny to think, like, they have to go to all of these events, and they have to be very dressy. But then, you know, like celebrities, they can't wear the same thing twice. So what is happening to all of these things? Do we know, like, do you follow any of these other kinds of collections? Or this one, because it ended up here?
Mostly just this one. There was also a mirror that was sent down to the Historical Society of North Dakota. Mm-hmm. But as for anything else, there were 9 trunks total in the wedding gift. So there would have been a lot of items to try to track down.
Have we tracked down any of those other items?
Just that mirror is all I know of.
So there's trunks worth of things that were shipped over from Queen Victoria, maybe somewhere in North Dakota?
Could possibly be. Yeah, up in this area especially. There's all kinds of treasures.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for stopping.
That was Jennifer Willis, the executive director of the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby. The Queen Victoria dress is part of the museum's permanent collection. Admission is $8, and it is a very fun dress to look at. Coming up next, food access for kids.
Support for Pray Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
There's a lot you can see in the mountains of Switzerland.
You might see a marmot. There's lots of marmots up there.
Or on the streets of Rome.
Over 2,000 years of history in front of your eyes every single moment, wherever you turn, all at once.
Or relax a while in one of the world's great garden parks.
They are an oasis away from the madness of electronica.
Escape with us on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And imagine for a moment that feeling that you have when you are hungry. It's easy to get irritable. It's easy to lose your ability to focus. Now imagine if you had that feeling often. We are going to talk about hunger and expanded access to food now with the Great Plains Food Bank Program Director, Nancy Caravu. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
2021, you will be expanding your Youth Summer Meals Program. So for starters, what is the Youth Summer Meals Program?
Yeah, the Youth Summer Meals, what that does is it's a way to provide meals for kiddos in the summer that normally rely on the school lunches that they get during the school year. And we are one of many programs across the state that provide summer meals. A lot of the schools do it, YMCAs, Boys and Girls Clubs, and we help provide in some of those gap communities that might not have a school participating in the program or that operates past the summer school months. And so we help make sure that those kids are getting the food they need throughout summer as well, because they are busy and running around and need lots of food to eat.
How do you know how many kids to anticipate feeding?
We really rely heavily on our community partners in those communities. So we find a community champion that knows that community well, you know, who the kids are in that neighborhood, wherever we do it, because we do these all based on different neighborhoods. And so either they've been in that district and have worked with the schools, or they have community programming that they already offer that we couple with. And so then we're able to just kind of, we do a little guesstimate, you know, we might guess that there's 50 kids in that neighborhood that will need it. And then that might increase a little bit each time. But we're also able to pull free and reduced numbers in neighborhoods and kind of get an idea of where those kids are located. And that's really how we gauge where to go.
And how do you classify the need in North Dakota specific to young people?
Yeah, and so we really look at those free and reduced numbers and know where there's kids that are needing that assistance with the schools to be able to provide them the meals. And then that's where we go and serve those meals. And this year, differently than in years past, we're able to expand because typically we can only go to communities that are deemed eligible by USDA. And USDA has removed all of those waivers due to COVID. And so while we know that there is a need in a community, if it's not census data driven to show it has a need, we aren't necessarily eligible to do those meals there. So we're really fortunate that we can expand where we know that there's a need with kids needing food in multiple different neighborhoods across the state this year.
So you've gone from 7 to this year now you'll have more than double that. You'll have 18 locations. Going back to those waivers that were removed by the USDA because of the pandemic, why are they there?
That's a really great question. And so, you know, we've benefited from this and schools have benefited from this. So you may have seen, you know, how schools have been allowed to give meals away at the school to take home during the distance learning time. Mm-hmm. It's those same waivers that affect us just the same. So they, you know, there's a lot of reasons that USDA has some of these waivers in place to for eligibility reasons. And so that's all based on, they do income-based guidelines. They do some other guidelines of kids usually typically have to stay and eat the meals for a half hour on site. So different nutritional guidelines that they have that they waived all that. So we're able to have a kiddo can come to us on a Monday and get meals for 5 days. So instead of having to come back Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we can give them 5 meals, shelf-stable meals on one day to take home. So there's been a lot of barriers removed that's been allowing us to serve so many more kids. So we're really hoping that we can help have these conversations to ensure that some of the things stay this way and that we don't go back to the way we used to do it.
Yeah. Normal is just what you're used to, right? Not necessarily what's right.
Yeah, exactly.
How does this change the staffing and volunteer and food needs? How are you able to meet this increased ability to serve?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we very much rely on our community partners that help us with this. So like, for instance, in West Fargo, we have a great partnership with the Little Red Reading Bus. The Little Red Reading Bus is operated by the West Fargo Education Foundation, and they go to different neighborhoods already and do a library on wheels. And so we've found it really beneficial when we partner with these already existing network of community partnerships, and they now serve the meals and do a farmer's market with that. And so we wouldn't have the staffing capacity to do what we were able to do this year without hiring more. So we really lean on some of those community partnerships that are already doing some of the work with kids that can help just also get meals out, and then makes it for a really easy transition into doing that. And we have a really great volunteer force of folks that help.
How did you pick the communities that you'll be expanding into? Granora, Trenton, Castleton, Mapleton, among others.
Yeah, and so some of it's been if they reach out to us and the expressed need from the community. Granora and Trenton are super exciting for us because we have never done summer meals past that Bismarck line. So we are extending as far west as we can possibly go now. We had had an original granting opportunity to do some additional work out there, but then this we had some community partners that were really excited about it, and they're anticipating serving over 100 children a week, and that's incredible out in those really tiny little communities out there. They're not very big, but they know that there's a lot of kids that are in need. And so we did look at those free and reduced numbers out there, and they are higher. And so once we were able to identify that and identify the community partners, it was just a no-brainer to help get those meals out there.
What happens to the brain, the just emotional development of a kid with food insecurity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that kids that are going hungry and that aren't getting enough food to eat, it's harder for them to concentrate. It's harder for them, you know, they're going to be more tired during the school day. They might not sleep as well at night, and they just have a harder time functioning like a kiddo that's getting all the meals that they need to do. And so we've been able to show that kids that are getting access to these meals or access to, you know, our backpack program or school pantries are coming to school feeling like they can participate and thrive during the school year and just during the day, and feel like they can just feel like a normal kid. You know, they just get to feel like a normal kid like everyone else and not worry about being hungry and where they're going to get food for themselves and for their siblings.
You talked about these kids have the opportunity now, for example, to show up on Monday and get a full week's worth of meals instead of having to come every single day, which could be some kind of transportation logistic hassle or what have you. So let's talk about balancing planning out these meals. You want shelf stable so that they last all week, but there has to be an element of ability to cook it, and then also the element of typically the healthiest food is the least shelf stable. So how do you balance these?
Yeah, we've practiced and tried lots of different ways of doing this, and there are different meal programs throughout the state that do different ways. So a lot of the schools and the YMCAs and things like that do get cooked, like a full cooked meal that they'll serve, you know, whether it's through their lunch line or through a lunch program that they have on site. We had tried that once ourselves, but we don't cook meals ourselves. And so we've found to really expand on our backpack program we do, which we work with vendors that really have worked hard to create shelf stable food that can be a lot more nutritious, less sodium, less sugar, more whole grains, some fruits and vegetables in there as well, that don't require either a lot of cooking or can be just eaten kind of like a healthy version, shelf-stable version of like a lunch bowl. Like there's like a pizza kit they can get or a hummus and crackers. So we have different options that they can have through that, and we are constantly evaluating those to see what's the best opportunity to get for them. But yeah, the challenge is a lot of those community partners we work with might not have storage for anything that would not be shelf-stable, so to have coolers and freezers to store food. But there's definitely a lot of vendors that we work with that provide lots of options because they work with food banks all over the country that do similar programs as us. But we've definitely made lots of changes over the years to ensure that we are getting the highest quality food for the kids and listening to them, what they don't like and like, because they definitely tell you.
They are good at that.
They are. And then interestingly, we also do a farmer's market at a couple of our sites. So we provide fresh fruits and vegetables to them as well to take home. Mm. On a weekly basis. So that helps balance them and to get some fresh food.
Yeah, the pandemic certainly highlighted a lot of gaps, let's just say, in our food system. And there has been a little bit of a resurgence of people interested in growing their own food. Has that at all impacted your work, your donations at all?
Yeah, we get quite a few local growers, whether it's your backyard gardener or your master gardener or your some of our larger farmers, like even our corn growers that grow corn and then they grow a little sweet corn on the side. Those donations are wonderful and we love them. And they've, you know, we saw a little bit of an increase in some of them last year. And then we are always looking for more healthy, fresh produce to go to our food pantry partners across the state and to us. And so that's a super exciting thing that we're always looking for more opportunities to, you know, sometimes we can help get volunteers for folks to help pick some of that produce if they have a lot of it. You know, a whole couple of rows of corn can take a little bit longer to pick. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to be able to help find volunteers, but that's wonderful. It's always something we're trying to increase with our network.
I was reading your bio on the Great Plains Food Bank website, and you are very open about your own food insecurity issues that came about after your child was born. And there is so much shame, so much stigma that can be associated with needing SNAP benefits, formerly known as the food stamps, or being on the WIC program. Why is it so important to share the story of a hardworking married mother who needs benefits like this?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one thing. You know, we know there's, I had a mentor one time in my life that told me in some other work I did, she said, Nancy, we're always one drop of a coin away from being on the other side of where we are and mm-hmm. needing these assistance services, whatever that might be, if that's food assistance, if that's SNAP, if that's housing assistance, because we never know what life is going to throw you. And you may be the most fortunate person ever, but knowing that we are no different than each other and that a lot of us fall on times that we're needing help. And so if we can be in neighborhoods and communities that provide that and can support each other and break down those shame and all the shame that goes with it, right? Because there's a lot of shame that goes along with asking for help and needing support. And it's just really important to me to be able to share that information and be transparent about it. And there's been quite a few of us at the food bank that have been able to share those stories because we know that it exists, but we also know that with the right help and assistance, people can get out of that as well.
Nancy Caravu is the Great Plains Food Bank Program Director, and she joined me today to talk about an expansion of the Youth Summer Meals Program. Nancy, congratulations on being able to expand the program, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Last year, we spoke to Bob Boylan of NPR Music and host of the Tiny Desk Concert about NPR's annual Tiny Desk Contest, which is on again right now.
What words of encouragement, what advice would you give a Prairie musician who wants to enter this contest?
People think they have to get videographers and amazing scenery or whatever to attract our attention. It's the music, plain and simple.
Unsigned musicians 18 and older, record a video of yourself playing one original song at the desk of your choice and upload it to YouTube.
Just get out and do it and represent who you are and tell the world.
The winner will play their very own Tiny Desk Concert. And if you don't win,
that's okay. You've done something with your music to get it in more and more hands.
The deadline for entry for the 2021 Tiny Desk Contest is Monday, June 7th. Go to npr.org/tinydeskcontest to enter and for complete contest details. Prairie musicians, let's represent.
I love the encouragement. Get out and start recording, folks.
Hey!
This is Dakota Datebook, May 26th. This week, in 1910, the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican newspaper revealed an interesting potpourri of life in the Red River Valley. At the Fargo Opera House, the senior class of the Fargo High School presented an American citizen, under the direction of Mrs. Remington, and featuring Rupert's Orchestra. Earlier in the week, the opera presented The Pirates of Penzance, featuring the Dakota Conservatory Chorus and Orchestra. Seats for both productions could be purchased at Castleman's Drugstore. Ticket prices varied. Gallery seats were a quarter, with better seats costing 50 cents and 75 cents, or a whole dollar. In local baseball, the Aggies of North Dakota Agricultural College were about to face St. Thomas. The newspaper called it a battle royal, saying, with the sting of defeat at Grand Forks still fresh, the St. Thomas ball team will line up against the Fargo College this afternoon here. Fargo's men are in fit trim and should give a good account of themselves. Downtown, at the P.J. Berquist store on Fargo's Broadway, Armour's lunch tongue special for Saturday was 30 cents per can. Also, the ad boasted of the store's herring in tomato sauce, packed in Scotland and unusually delicious, and a gold medal winner. Plus, olive salad, a new delicacy, very palatable. Regular, 20 cents. Special for Saturday per glass jar, 2 for 35 cents. An ad for Eggert's Market boasted fancy fresh-killed hens, 20 cents per pound, and fancy imported fat mackerel at 25 cents a pound. At the Home Tea Company on Fargo's Front Street, now Main Avenue, customers were enticed with a 50-cent can of fern baking powder and a free decorated water jug with tulip landscape or Dutch design. A soap special boasted 3 bars of Merry Widow, fancy toilet paper, and a splendid hairbrush for 35 cents. Finally, an ad at the bottom of a page read, "You'll want it in the morning and again at night." What? The Gardner Hotel coffee at all leading grocers. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The CDC says racism is a serious health threat. As a result, black women, especially those who are pregnant, are seeking out black doctors. But that presents another problem.
If every black woman wanted to have a black physician, it would be virtually impossible. The numbers are not there.
How some medical schools are trying to fix an inherent racial bias on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we are going to discuss a new quarterly forecast out for the economy of North Dakota. What parts of the state are showing recovery and which areas are still in a slowdown? And joining me for that discussion is Jeremy Jackson, professor of economics at North Dakota State University. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.